Hello and welcome to Blogosphere Serious Influence, the podcast all about the business side of the influencer industry. I'm Alice Audley and I'm the founder of Blogosphere, which hopefully you've heard of. But if not, Blogosphere is a media company rooted in the world of influencers. We run events, an influencer network, and publish a nationally distributed print magazine. And now a podcast too, which I'll be presenting. If there are any questions about the influencer industry that you want answered, be sure to tweet us your suggestions. Our Twitter handle is @BlogosphereM. And if you want to learn more about influencers and the influencer industry, be sure to visit blogosphere magazine.com and invest in a subscription to our essential magazine. I'm delighted to announce that this series of Serious Influence is being exclusively sponsored by our very own tech platform, the Blogosphere Network. The Blogosphere Network is a platform where brands and influencers can feedback on what it was actually like to work with each other on campaigns. Real, qualitative data. If you'd like a demo of the service, please drop us an email at info@blogosphere.biz. That's info@blogosphere.biz. It's time to bring back the human touch to this human industry. Today on Blogosphere Serious Influence, I'm joined by Tom Cornish, who is Influencer Marketing Director at the media agency Wavemaker. Wavemaker has a very data-driven approach to influencer marketing, and as part of their offering to brands, operate a guaranteed engagement model. Tom has worked in the influencer space since 2011, when he worked at Ketchum PR, creating content for brands.
I'm the Influencer Marketing Director at Wavemaker. We do a lot of influencer stuff, working with a number of different brands in different capacities, and so my responsibility is to kind of lead that function and make sure that we're working with the right partners in the right way.
So can you take me back a bit to actually kind of your background? So what did you sort of study at university and how did you get on your career ladder? Like, how have you ended up where you are today?
Well, at university, I did politics because I didn't know what I wanted to do. I did it at A-level and sort of quite enjoyed it. So really had no clear picture in my head of what I wanted to do. And then came out and after a couple of tries with different things that weren't really right, I ended up working in PR in a sort of social media team and was very lucky to work at Ketchum, which is kind of quite a reputable PR agency. Worked there for a while.
What sort of years are we in now?
So this is 2011. So I was there for a number of years, which was great because they've got a lot of big brands. They work on a lot of international accounts and had the chance to work with some great people. So I was doing that for a while, but as I say, within the kind of social function rather than being traditional PR.
So what were your sort of responsibilities then?
Because this was a number of years ago, there was a lot of content calendars and writing social posts and managing feeds and things back when there was a much greater volume of content that you were creating. There was this sort of thing around brands should be communicating on a much more regular basis on social with their audiences, daily stuff, writing about things that perhaps sometimes aren't entirely necessary for the brand to be talking about.
What sort of platforms was the focus on at that time?
There was a lot of Twitter at that time. Also, Facebook. That was largely it. This is before Instagram was really a thing that people were involved with. I remember...
Well, that was founded in 2010, wasn't it?
So that wasn't really a major focus for us at that time. But we sort of got to the point where we were working across this huge number of brands, creating a lot of content, and you sort of get that ability to filter out what doesn't need to be said just purely by the volume of stuff that you're working with. So that was a really good experience.
Earlier, when you said brands were talking about things that they didn't necessarily need to be talking about, what do you mean by that?
So we always used to sort of joke about this, really, which was that if you start off writing a kind of calendar of content, then you're kind of doing it backwards, because what you're doing is you're looking at all of the days in the month and trying to figure out what you can say on each of them. Whereas what you should be doing is figuring out what you need to say and then the best sort of moments in time in which to do so. So you would see brands saying things like, oh, it's International Smiling Day or something. And this is, you know, it's not relevant to the brand, but because there was something that had some degree of stickiness, you know, kind of media appeal, that they would try and jump on it. And that's what I mean by participating in conversations that you don't really have the right to, but just doing so because they're there. And I think that's actually something that kind of translates into influencer marketing as well, which is all about picking the right message and the right people and not just assuming that you've got a right to talk about anything you like with anybody you like, but making the right decisions.
Do you think the brands trying to get in on all of those conversations in an effort just to create content actually alienated their consumers?
I think possibly in some of the worst cases, they did.
What was one of the worst cases?
Oh, gosh, you've put me on the spot there. I won't name names, but we did used to see in the comments people saying things like, why on earth are you talking about this? This has absolutely no relevance to what your brand is about, what you sell, or really who your audience is. And you would see things like that coming out.
At that time, were you looking at the comments and then feeding back to your superiors saying, I think this is...
Yeah.
Do you think they were sort of grappling with social media as a great, we can reach all of these people, but hadn't really thought it through? And do you think that since you've been involved in this world, that brands have become savvier?
Yes, they've certainly become savvier. And I think it also sort of bears mentioning that nobody really knew the right way to do this at that time. And there were lots of people who went through exactly the same process that I'm talking about of trying to figure out, what do we have a right to talk about? When do we have a right to talk about it and to whom? And the industry was young at the time, it still is, but obviously those things were kind of being ironed out.
Definitely translates into influencer marketing, but can you tell me a bit about your move from Ketchum to Wavemaker? How did that happen? And you've obviously moved into a marketing position.
That's right, yeah. So on paper, it's a move from the PR industry into the media industry, but in reality, as I said, when I was in PR, I was kind of doing social stuff and that translated into content marketing and it kind of bleeds into some of the other stuff like partnerships, big brand activations. And then I was kind of drawn to the media agency approach because the fact that social was a very young industry meant that the value of having anything measurable at all is enormous because you just don't have any basis. You don't have years of experience to say, well, this is how things ought to be done. So having a data-driven approach sort of unlocks a lot of doors and helps you make decisions. What I was just talking about with the creating content for content's sake thing, if you've got the data to hand, which kind of informs you as to whether that's working and whether you ought to be doing it, you're in a better position. And I think media agencies in general are more comfortable with starting from data, because obviously they're responsible for massive budgets in other media channels. And that's all kind of advised by data. But particularly at Wavemaker, it was clear that everything had to start from that. That's your kind of first step. And any decisions that you make, you're going to have to be informed by the data that you've got to hand. So
were you when you were at Ketchum, were you working with influencers as well? When did that sort of start? And did you have budget for influencers or was it done purely on a gifting kind of basis, and was that one of the appeals? Because obviously you can get more data when you actually put budget down.
Sure. We did do some influencer stuff at Ketchum, and I believe they're still doing some great stuff over there. Obviously that's come from the PR mindset, so it's much more kind of relationship oriented. I mean, I can't speak for what they're doing now, but at the time I was working there, you weren't going out and paying for people's participation in campaigns. And in fact, the kind of notion of doing that was a little bit alien and it was seen as not the right thing to do because this should be authentic. I think we've moved past that as an industry now and we've realized that the professionalization of the industry means that people should get paid for the work that they're doing. So we were doing, again, very much in its infancy, but we were doing little bits of influencer stuff on the side. That gave me a bit of a flavor, but I think that the way that we do it at Wavemaker is so different to what we were doing before that it was almost a new approach entirely.
Did you have relationships with influencers from your time at Ketchum? And do you think that obviously the kind of opposites with Wavemaker being data-driven and Ketchum being relationship-driven, but with influencer marketing, do you think that it ever can get to a position of being purely data when it is a human industry?
I think that there will always be a role for data, and that it will always be one of the most important factors in helping us make decisions and helping clients make decisions. Because if you look at other media, that's how it works. That's not to say that having a productive relationship and understanding who an influencer is and what their values are is sort of incompatible with having a data-oriented approach, because all of that kind of qualitative stuff exists in other media as well. You know, you have to know what a publication is about, what their editorial staff are inspired to do, what their tone of voice is. You have to have a relationship with them. You can look at adding value to clients as a result of that relationship. So any media channel you can name really is a combination of understanding the quantitative value through data and the qualitative value that you can add through a relationship. So I think there's always going to be both.
So you move over to Wavemaker. The appeal is data-driven, having access to those insights. What year are we in now?
This would be 2014, 15. And at that time, the influencer proposition was sort of, it was a bit further along in my mind than it had been at places I'd worked previously, but it still hadn't sort of come completely into fruition and been sort of realized as what it is now. There was sort of little bits of it going on in different departments. There wasn't any real consistency from campaign to campaign in the way that we would plan, partner, sort of pay and then measure. So if you kind of looked at campaigns in isolation, you would have a lot of interesting insight and stuff, but then you couldn't really say, was this a success compared to what we did last year or compared to what we did a couple of weeks ago for a different brand? So we kind of had to get to a point where everything went through the same process in order for us to be able to understand relative success.
Did you start in the position of heading up influencer marketing?
No.
So what was your job?
So I came in to the digital engagement team, which essentially is your kind of social media team, content creation and strategy and that kind of thing. And when I initially came in, I was working across all of that. So I was doing social accounts for some of our big clients, working on content partnerships and things like that occasionally as well, and kind of moved into a bit of a planning role within that team. So that was really enjoyable because that's, to my mind, about deciding what we are going to do and what we are not going to do. So you start to look at the relative benefits of different ways of spending money, essentially. Then the influencer piece gained a bit of momentum. We did a couple of really successful campaigns early on.
What campaigns were they?
So we did a great campaign for C2C, which is a rail operator. And this is sort of my favorite campaign to talk about, really, because it's with respect to C2C, that's not the most glamorous brand. You know, it doesn't sort of jump out with a sort of value proposition as if I'd said Nike or someone like that. But they wanted to get more people to take the train down the Essex coast to places like Southend, which can be quite a difficult ask for people. But, you know, there's lots of great places down there that they just didn't think the audience knew about. So they wanted to get people from London to take the train for the day. So what we did, and this was probably now 2.5 years ago or something, we found a bunch of influencers, each of whom had a specific interest or something about them that we could sort of respond to. And then we created bespoke itineraries for them and sent them off for the day for a walk on the beach or to a gastropub or to an arcade or something that would be relevant to them. And that's what they created their content about. The premise being that C2C was what got them there. So it wasn't pictures of influencers sitting on a train or standing at the platform at the station. It was about what the brand facilitated, what it made possible for them. And that worked really, really well. We did some econometric modeling, which is one of the things we can do at Wavemaker because of the kind of data heritage. And through that, we realized that this had been hugely profitable in terms of the number of incremental journeys that had generated. We'd inspired people because if you're thinking, well, what am I going to do this weekend? And then you see something that is inspiring, it sort of taps into the thing that you follow the influencer for. That can have a huge effect. That can actually make people change their plans and change their behavior. And that's what we saw through the campaign.
Could you explain to me a bit more about the ergonomics and data side of Wavemaker and the analytics that you have access to?
Yeah. So I think that the important thing there is that Wavemaker has obviously got a responsibility to its clients to be able to inform them on the relative benefits of spending money in different media channels. So they're not just going to say, spend all of your money on TV if there is a case to be made for spending it somewhere else. So because Wavemaker must do that for its clients, we have to be able to understand the relative value of all of those channels.
Using C2C as an example, what were the statistics that you could access there?
So what we looked at was ticket sales data for various stations across London. And what that does, of course, is it gives you a very, very clear idea, not just of what people have bought, but, you know, where they've got on the train and where they've got off it.
How do you have access to that data?
C2C have access to it directly from TfL, I believe, and then they give it to us in order for us to run this analysis. And what happens is over a period of time, you're able to, by, I'm maybe speaking out of turn here and a data person will correct me, but essentially you dial up and down different activities. So a bit more on TV, a bit more on radio, a bit more on out of home. And as you do so, you watch what happens to sales. That enables you to fairly accurately determine what the effective sales value is of every pound you spend in each media channel. So you can say, well, TV will deliver us this many sales. Beyond a certain point, it sort of starts to tail off. So you've got all of this in a model. And then what you do is you add something new. And as soon as you add something new, any uplift that sort of exceeds what the model would suggest, you can attribute to the thing that's new. And that's what we did with influencers. So they had a fairly clear and fairly accurate model, sort of over 90% accuracy, which would say, for the money that we're going to spend, this is what we're going to expect. Then we put the influencers in and we generated X additional sales. So that's where those sales have come from. As a simplification, and as I say, there may be an oversimplification, but that's essentially how it works.
And so did you report back on that campaign? How does the sort of inside of Wavemaker, do you have superiors that you reported that back to, and then because of its success, people wanted to allocate more budget towards it? How have you seen influence marketing within Wavemaker expand during your tenure?
It's expanded exponentially, really. It's become huge now. And it was things like C2C which took the sort of abstract potential of influencers and turned it into a tangible business result that we're then able to go and talk to our clients, to prospective clients, and also kind of more broadly in the industry about this is what influencer marketing can do. So since that happened, as I say, about 2.5 years ago, probably, we've started to see more and more clients come to us asking for influencer marketing solutions. And they're doing so because they've got a degree of assurance that it's going to work fairly well. This year, we will have done campaigns for perhaps 30 different brands across the portfolio. Some of them very sort of small challenger brands, other ones really well established. And that's something that we expect to grow next year.
Do you have brands coming to you that are outside of your portfolio that want access to Wavemaker purely for your influencer marketing department?
We've had some early conversations with brands on that basis. What we normally find, though, is that taking the C2C work as a classic example, if we've got clients who are already spending money with us in other media channels and who have sort of built up a bit of an appreciation of the value of that, then it becomes very easy for us to go and talk to them about influencers. If you just come to Wavemaker and solely do influencers, that's great and we'll deliver you guaranteed results and all of that stuff. But the added value of having the decision-making engine that Wavemaker's got to help you make choices about where you're going to put money is you're not getting quite so much of a benefit from that. So it's something that we will do more of, but the focus this year has been on existing clients.
Do you think that brands are going to different influencer agencies, kind of specific smaller outfits to test it and then not necessarily having the best experience and then coming back to you?
Yes, we've seen that with a number of clients. And in fact, that can happen in a fairly short turnaround. So that can happen in a matter of months. You see them go, well, okay, I get the value of it now. We're going to go and do our thing. And, you know, sometimes that does work for them. And if that does work for them, then that's great. But quite often you'll see clients come around in it and it hasn't really been as straightforward as they may have expected it to be. It's important to say, though, that I don't think that's really says anything about the networks themselves. It's more about the client preparedness for running a campaign and planning one.
What do you think are the most common mistakes that brands are making when it comes to testing out influencer marketing?
One of the ones that I see a lot is trying to choose influencers who are your audience. And this is something we talk about quite a lot in some of the campaigns that we run. The way that influencers present themselves is naturally quite aspirational. And the audiences that those influencers have aspire to be like the influencers in whatever way. It could be something very specific, like the influencer has a particular talent that people aspire to emulate, or it could be a lifestyle thing. And I think a lot of clients make the mistake of thinking, well, this influencer is a little bit too high end or luxury for what we want to talk about. And what you're doing there is you're missing the fact that the influencer doesn't need to be the target audience. The influencer needs to give you access to the target audience. And if they are talking about a product which their audience is going to be genuinely interested in and that their audience could see them using, that's what really matters, much more than the selection of the kind of group of influencers as a representative sample of the target audience.
How do you find that out? Is that access to data as well? So you may have an...
One of the things that we do through Group M, who sort of administer a lot of the deals that we have with networks, is that we require a certain amount of data from them. So we can look at audience composition by age, gender and location and things like that. But you can also start to look at brand affinities and things like that. So if an influencer's audience are particularly receptive to certain messages from other brands, you can start to understand where the brand that you're representing might fit into that mix.
I would like to talk about that a bit more. Can you just explain that? Because we've obviously mentioned Group M there. You work for Wavemaker. Can you please explain the relationships within it, how that works? Because you're in a big kind of portfolio company under the umbrella of WPP.
That's right. So without the capacity to draw a diagram, I'm going to try my best here. So all of the WPP media agencies, of whom Wavemaker is one, also Mediacom, Mindshare and Essence, various others like that, are part of Group M. And what Group M does is it essentially brings together the scale that all of those agencies have as a group and uses it to deliver extra value to clients. So the very fact that those agencies are part of Group M allows Group M the negotiating power to go to media owners and suppliers, basically negotiate deals as a block. What that means is that the clients of those agencies benefit from massive scale through Group M, but they still get the specific service and approach and strategy that the individual agencies provide, which is why essentially the product that we use is available to all Group M agencies, but the way that we use it is unique to us.
And Group M sits directly underneath WPP.
That's right. So Group M is the business which administrates the media agencies within WPP.
And the media agencies within, although you have access to the same product, are you all independent?
Yes. So we're all independent. We can choose to use it or not. We're not sort of obligated to, even if we do use it, to use it in a certain way. And that's why if you were a client of Mediacom, for instance, the response that you might get to an influencer brief would be entirely different from what you get from Wavemaker. The best analogy would be that we just sort of use the same machinery to make sure that we get value for clients. But what we propose and how we plan it and how it manifests itself and the content will be totally different.
Does that sometimes not conflict? Are you kind of competitive with each other?
We are competitive with each other. And I think that if it were ever to conflict, that would become immediately obvious and it would not be something that we would ever want.
Do you fight the same briefs?
We have done. Yeah. One of the things that we sort of want to do next year, I think, as a bigger group, is to make decisions about which agency is best placed to respond to certain briefs, certainly on like a bigger new business client acquisition level. That's something that we want to move into doing.
And where would you say Wavemaker is the strongest compared to the other agencies?
Oh, wow. That's a good question. Well, my personal opinion is that Wavemaker is particularly good at spotting new solutions to give to clients and developing those into products. So to use the example of influencers, we are now at the end of a full year of offering this to clients. And as I said, we've done so for a number of clients. The other GroupM agencies aren't quite there yet. Some of them are starting to do it. Some of them have done a small number. But I think what Wavemaker is really good at is picking that out, identifying it as a growth opportunity, not just for the agency, but for clients, and then turning it into something that they can basically buy.
Could you give an example of something like that?
Only speaking from my personal experience, the influencer product that we offer is the best example of it. But we also, through our precision team, which is a totally different type of media altogether, they see their sort of function as a product business. So they are building products which are data-led tech products for clients to be able to spend their budgets more effectively, understand the impact of their campaigns to a greater degree. And all of that stuff, I think, is the output of our kind of mindset as a business, which is different to what some of the other GroupM agencies are about.
I just want to kind of clarify. You've talked about the machine of GroupM.
Yeah.
What do you kind of mean by that? Is that the access to GroupM's data?
So what GroupM did in setting up this machine is that they went out into the market and they spoke to a number of the biggest and most reputable influencer networks. So
what is this machine?
So it's essentially a set of deals that GroupM has got in place with these networks. And what it does is it brings together all of the different services that the different networks provide, all of the influencers that they've got access to.
Is this sort of talent agencies or networks like third-party apps or the platforms themselves?
So it will be people like Indahash, for example, Bazool, or another group in the deal. And the idea is that you bring them all together and essentially standardize the service that they offer. You also, in doing so, sort of stitch together the scale that they can all offer. So through GroupM, you can then put out an influencer brief and access 5 or 6 different networks at once. And what you get back is a standardized response. You get standardized data to measure it. And then you get the sort of planning processes that Wavemaker offer and the kind of creative ideation and stuff. So what that means is that rather than having to go and brief a network directly, subject to the costs that they would potentially offer you and the availability of the influencers that they have sort of in a singular way, you can give the brief to Wavemaker and we access everybody. We can, for instance, take some influencers from one network and some from another without having to do sort of twice as much project management from the point of view of the client. So it's simpler, which is, as I said earlier, is something that I think clients really benefit from. Also, as I said, because of the kind of negotiating power that GroupM has, we're able to secure much more preferential commercial rates and then pass those on to our clients as well. The other thing that we're able to do is that we operate on a guaranteed engagement model. So rather than just paying an influencer to participate in a campaign and not having any kind of assurance of how well the content's going to perform, what we do for clients is we guarantee a number of engagements from the campaign. What that means is that if for whatever reason, and it very, very rarely happens, that an influencer's content isn't right, isn't planned correctly, isn't briefed properly from us, and therefore doesn't perform as well as it ought to, we will add more influencers or revisit briefs with influencers at no additional cost to the client to get them to the engagement level that we've guaranteed.
And what do the networks that are part of that, say the Bazool and Indahash, what is the benefit for them that they have guaranteed access to more briefs coming through?
That's right. So I think that's the sort of main benefit. The other one being that particularly people like Bazool and Indahash have now established a really good reputation. And what they want are long-term relationships with other reputable companies that are going to give them access to the big clients. So this is mutually beneficial. Obviously, we have a bit of a preferential arrangement with them and we have this sort of scale through the deal.
In terms of the commission, because I think the networks work on big commissions that go through their platforms when they're working with brands direct.
That's right, yeah. So to be completely transparent, we take a bit of that. But what it means is that from Indahash's point of view, for example, they know that they're going to get a certain volume of briefs from a certain caliber of client over a certain period of time. And that assurance is really important for those slightly younger businesses to grow.
How many networks are actually tied into this machine?
At last count, I believe we have sort of 5 or 6 different networks. We're always looking to talk to new people because obviously that will keep our scale, that will keep our offering current and as of higher quality as possible. And then, you know, you can negotiate deals with them. So sometimes networks will join, they'll drop out, or they might be there on certain terms, but not others. And this ties to what I said earlier, which is that we don't have to use that deal. So if we had a client that said, I really, really want to work with a network that isn't in the deal, it's absolutely fine. And we would put a plan in place direct with that network. So it gives us a lot of options, really.
Do you have the functionality to cross-reference influencers who are part of one network to another? So for instance, you have 5 or 6 at the moment, but if you want to add another network, you think that you're getting another 10,000 in scale on influencers, but actually there isn't really, from my personal opinion, much loyalty when you sign up to one influencer platform. Yep. You're probably going to sign up to the others. So how do you combat that?
It's a very good point in that lots of influencers will be a part of a number of different networks. I don't really see that necessarily as an issue because when we're working with clients and we want to choose the influencers who are going to participate, they'll still only be counted once. It will just be a decision as to who we access that influencer through. And of course, the scale of the influencers, the volume of influencers, is only really one consideration in choosing a network partner. So there might be somebody who comes in and says, we've got lots and lots of influencers who nobody else has got, but maybe from a specific geography or a specific interest group. But other things will be the level of data that we can get from them, how well we can do different types of campaigns. So could we activate into different channels? Could we include shoppability? Could we have measurement studies bolted onto the back of them and things like that? So it's not really an issue. It's something that we're aware of, but we haven't found it to be a problem in negotiating with any of the networks.
When you are working on that guaranteed engagement and scale model, what is it that you are trying to achieve in terms of return on investment, as opposed to working more, say, strategically with one macro influencer when you're working with these micro influencers?
Sure. Well, I think the first thing that we always try and do is sort of get clients to see micro influencers and the relationship that they want to develop with them as not really a million miles away from what they would do with big influencers. I think there can be a bit of a tendency to just get people to just get, you know, 40 or 50 people to hold up a product, and that's a micro-influencer campaign. But that's not a great micro-influencer campaign. So
what is a great micro-influencer campaign?
I think a great micro-influencer campaign is the same as a great macro-influencer campaign. It's about having a degree of brand affinity. It's about people in the influencer's audience feeling that the brand has given the influencer something relevant and appealing to talk about. They haven't bought their credibility off them in order to put a product in front of me. What they've done is they've given that influencer an experience. They've sent them out to do something, or they've shared something with them that makes sense for the influencer, and therefore it makes sense for me. So I think to the ROI question, there is no difference in terms of what you're looking for from micro influencers versus macro influencers. But what the guaranteed engagement model does is it means that we are better equipped to measure ROI, because if you work with a big influencer, normally what you will do is sort of secure their participation. But what you can't do, if that's your approach, is to secure the performance of the content that they generate. And that's kind of the end of the scale that we're on. So we go to clients and we don't just say, give us this money and we'll get you this person. We say, give us this money and we'll get you this performance. And, you know, we're a media agency, and that is, in our experience, what clients are more receptive to.
Do you sign off the content that goes onto the third-party platforms?
Yeah, so that was a big consideration for us. We appreciate that the model that I've been talking about feels a little bit convoluted, and that there would be a real danger that clients might feel a bit separate from what was actually going on with the influencers. So we have what we call the 3-point approval process. So the first thing is that the client will see and input into and feedback on the brief that is issued to these networks. So they're kind of happy with the question that's being asked. The next thing is that they get that same level of input into the suggested shortlist. So they're then happy with who is going to participate, what their profile's like, what their audience is like. And then they get the same for the content before it is published. So we've got all of the same kind of input. We offer all of the same input that you would get if you went to a network directly, because we didn't want clients to feel like they're a bit blind to what happens once a campaign is underway.
And I wanted to talk to you about, obviously, it's guaranteed engagement, but engagement is something that people are proven to have bought engagement in addition to buying followers. So what measurements do you have in place?
So this is the kind of hot topic at the moment, isn't it? And we are fairly comfortable with the, I mean, we see the fake follower argument as being pretty much moot at this point, because we can spot when that's happened because of the data access that we've got. So we can see things like massive follow and unfollow variants. We can see when people have acquired large number of followers. We can see when people's engagement rate has dropped dramatically or increased dramatically. And we can use those as kind of signifiers of having fake followers.
Do you, after that, though, go in and look for reasons why that could be? Because sometimes it is, you know, someone's just gone viral.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So the sort of next step from having seen that is that we have to determine whether we take action. And that's got to be qualitative, because if somebody has gone viral, as you said, then that means that they've got genuinely, for that period of time, a massively increased number of eyeballs on them. And we wouldn't want to cut them out of a campaign prematurely. So what we do is that we're always monitoring that in our influencer selection, and we require of the networks that we work with that they're monitoring that as well. And if it's all above board and we can understand why it's happened, then that's great. If we can't, and we have beyond a reasonable doubt cause to believe that these people have bought followers, with a follower example, we will take them out of the campaign and replace them again at no additional cost to the client. That's one of the things that we guarantee.
Are those people informed that they've been removed from the campaign because of suspicious activity?
Yeah, and that will always be a kind of consultative process. I don't think you would ever get an email dropped into your inbox saying, sorry, game over. We would be in consultation with those people trying to figure it out. So I think that they would know if it was perfectly above board and authentic. They've got the opportunity to tell us why that's happened. It is harder with engagements than it is with followers, and that is why this is the kind of current topic that everyone's talking about. But similarly, there are certain things that you can look for. So you can look at things like the people, the profiles that are engaging with a piece of content. And then when you go in to look at who's commented, for instance, or liked, if they have a particularly imbalanced follower to following ratio, so nobody follows them, but they follow thousands, that's a good indicator that it's not a real account. If there's sort of missing data, there's no name, there's no location, there's no profile picture, that's another good indication. If they've never created anything, that's another good indication.
Is that all done manually, or do you have AI in place?
So the data that we guarantee to all of our clients for all of the work that we do will pick up some of that stuff. So if there has been a massive variance in an engagement rate, for instance, you sort of see it almost these big sort of steps up and then drops off. That's something that is sort of an automated red flag. But bearing in mind that we are probably choosing on average 20 to 30 influencers to fulfill a campaign, it's not actually beyond the realms of possibility to do this manually.
Is that the average number of influencers you use per campaign?
I would say so.
That's interesting. I thought it would be a lot more.
We have done campaigns with significantly more, but we tend to find that, because coming back to what I said earlier about there really being no difference in how you ought to look at value from micro and macro, you've got to invest a bit of time and a bit of effort in briefing people and choosing people on the right basis and understanding who they are and who their audiences are. So really, if you're going up into the realms of hundreds and hundreds, you're going to have to sacrifice that to an extent. And if you sacrifice that, you sacrifice a lot of value. And we don't really tend to do that for clients. There have been, as I say, examples where we've done that, but not many.
Do you have sort of tiered packages that you offer to clients? So is that sort of 100,000 engagements, 200,000 engagements?
Based on the parameters of the campaign, we will guarantee a certain number of engagements that are guaranteed cost per engagement. So it completely depends on...
And is that cost per engagement uniform for all of you?
It won't always be. It is affected by the scale of the campaign slightly. It's also affected by the nature of the content that's being created. So we have a kind of baseline that we will work off, but if we did that too sort of stringently, you would basically end up with us trying to fit the formulation of the campaign into a bit of a box so that we can then sell that to the client. And that's not the basis for a great client relationship. What you want to do is understand what the resources are that they have available and what they want to achieve. And once you've done that, you can say, right, well, this is the formulation, this is the structure that we would recommend. And what we're able to do at that structure is guarantee you this number of engagements calculated at that cost per engagement.
How many clients does Wavemaker have, roughly?
In
the UK.
In the UK. I mean, across all arms of our business, I can't tell you with total confidence, but we will probably have around 50 clients, I would have thought.
And then of those 50 clients, how many would you say are using influencer marketing as part of their strategy?
I would say at one time or another, about half of them. Well, actually, I say half of them. It's about the proportion that we work with. There are, of course, some clients who may use Wavemaker for like programmatic media buying who have a PR division which does influencers, but we're sort of so far removed from that that I can't see it from where I'm sitting. But the team that I work on probably touches about half of the clients.
And then of those clients, the sort of average spend that they have with Wavemaker is probably in the millions.
That's a very good point, actually. So most of them, yes. But as I said earlier, one of the things Wavemaker is great at doing is responding to, identifying and responding to issues like that and figuring out what we ought to do about it. So Wavemaker has a whole sister agency called Wavemaker Select, which is set up for clients that don't have millions and millions to spend. These are clients for whom budgets have to work a lot harder and they can't necessarily go and buy a massive TV campaign. So with influencers, we actually do a lot of work for these sort of high growth potential clients that Wavemaker Select are representing.
And then the clients that are just with Wavemaker who do have the bigger budgets, what sort of percentage are they spending out of that? Say you've got your big pie that they're spending. What is the kind of portion that they're
giving to influencers?
Exactly.
That would require some maths, I think. But we do, for instance, know that one of the big clients within Wavemaker has committed to spend 5% of its total media budget next year on influencers.
And is that high?
For that particular client, as a number, yeah, that's going to be massive.
So that's exciting for you.
Oh, hugely, yeah. And they've done that off the basis of work we did for them last year.
Do you think that you're going to see that across the board over the years
to
come?
We may arrive at that point. I don't want to say anything that that will end up in me being set some crazy target, if you see what I mean. But yeah, I think more clients will start spending more money with influencers. I personally feel like a sort of mandate to spend a certain budget in a certain channel is a bit counterintuitive unless you've got the data to suggest that that's what you ought to be doing. So I don't think clients will be coming to us saying we must spend 5% of our budget. But what they might do is say, we understand the value of influencers, so we've got this money available.
Do you normally get given budget from the clients working on an annual basis, or do they trial things sort of monthly?
2018 has been on a sort of campaign by campaign basis almost universally.
But this year,
2019, yes, I think that's what we're going to move into. We've got a number of plans in place already for the entirety of the year with clients. We are completely convinced, I think, that that's the best way to do this because you've got a bit of a longer view. Influencers like to be worked with on a slightly more long-term value-oriented basis rather than we need this from you next week or we need this from you in a couple of weeks' time. I'm convinced that planning that way is going to get us better content. It's going to get us more investment from influencers and it's going to start to build better relationships.
What's the biggest budget you've been given to date to spend on influencer marketing?
We've been doing some work for a big telecoms brand at the moment, which I can't talk too much about because it's still kind of in delivery. But our total for that is about 350.
And when you have a budget like that,
yeah,
it gives you a lot more opportunity to trial different elements within the space. And would you would you say that you, as a team, are quite proactive in finding new ways to engage with people in influencer marketing rather than reactive, despite being a big agency? And in the same point two of that is, with the competition, agile, small, lean, influencer specific agencies starting, can you move at the same pace as them?
I think there would always be a challenge for a bigger, more established agency to be able to sort of flex in quite the same way. However, I think that what we do have is the resource already in place to be able to sort of throw against things. So to give you a really good example of this, we work with a business called Zyper, who are very, very small. They've set up, and their whole thing is around sort of advocates rather than established influencers. So this could be people with a couple of hundred followers, but if they're the right people
who... That's Amber Atherton's company.
That is Amber's company, yeah. We've done some great work with them. And in fact,
how is that with the ASA, though, if you're brand advocates, but saying that you need to use certain hashtags? Isn't that a breach of the ASA guidelines? Because when you're saying that you have to have a specific hashtag or posting on, you know, the editorial control over it, then by default, it actually becomes an ad.
So
maybe a question for Amber.
Yeah, I think, please. So our perspective on that is that if we're ever under any doubt as to how a campaign would fall under the ASA guidelines, that we'd always err on the side of caution, which is to disclose it as an ad. The ASA guidelines, as we read them, is that you have to meet two criteria in order for something to be disclosed as an ad, and that's control and payment. So obviously, payment in kind qualifies as payment. So if you're giving an influencer a product, again, this is our interpretation, you're giving them a product by way of payment, you're paying them. But the control element is where this becomes quite interesting. So if you don't actually have control over what they're going to say, and they have within the kind of terms of the campaign, absolute freedom, should they choose to say something negative or developmental, then they can go and do that and you're not controlling what they say. So on that basis, you're kind of facilitating the content, but you're not controlling it. That sort
but then
of...
you want to track it through a hashtag, and if you say you need to use the hashtag, then that is control.
Well, we're not controlling...
I had to check with Rupa Shah, she was on the last series.
So we're not controlling... We don't see the images before they're published. We don't see the copy before it's published. And, you know, if we were to formulate a campaign in which we didn't require influencers or advocates to say that it was an ad, we would be very, very careful to make it clear that they can basically go and say whatever they want. When we're kind of working with these people, we have a team within Wavemaker whose responsibility is to give us access to these kind of guys at short, relatively short notice, and for us to be able to use the agility that they have through their structures in order to be able to deliver that for our clients. So Zyper is just one example of how we can give clients the newest stuff, the newest toys to play with, basically. But in doing so, the client still has the relationship, the established relationship with Wavemaker. They've still got all of the expertise and the sort of decision-making
the security
process
that you offer.
Absolutely.
Because you're going to do your due diligence on the agencies that you're working with.
That's right.
Do you think that networks and platforms are doing enough due diligence on the people and influencers who are on their platforms? Would you like to see them do a bit more of that?
I would like to see them do a bit more of that, which is a slightly different answer, I suppose, to saying that they're not doing enough of it at the moment, because I understand that that is a labour-intensive process.
Especially when you're working on a scale model.
Yeah, absolutely. It's something that if you're too rigorous with it, you could turn people off from working with your network at all. And I think it's an oversimplification for somebody like me from a media agency to say you have to overhaul your processes and be significantly better at this straight away in order for us to be prepared to work with you. These are new businesses. These are people working in new sectors. And so what I'm hoping is that over the coming years, months to years, you will start to see the quality of the processes improve. And I, from all the conversations I've had with people at networks, they get that as well. So we'll get there, is my point of view, but we have a responsibility to our clients to make sure that happens, and the networks have a responsibility to us and to clients directly to do the same thing.
Do you think that influencer marketing can ever get to the point of it being a straight media buy?
Yes, I think it probably can. Whether or not it should is a different question.
In your opinion, should it?
Probably not a straight media buy in the way that you would go and buy an ad placement on radio, for instance. And the interesting thing there is that if you look at the structure at Wavemaker, or you talk to Anna at MediaCom or Rahul at Ogilvy, the influencer piece still sits in content marketing, or whatever term that business uses to refer to content marketing. And content marketing is not about straight media buys. It's about creative solutions that sort of manifest themselves through the media. So I think that's always the way it will work. There's going to have to be more rigor. There's going to have to be more measurement. And we're going to have to get better at talking about return on investment. But I don't think it should ever be a case of, oh, we'll just buy this output or performance outcome through influencers, because that's not how it should work.
And finally, What are your predictions for the rest of 2019?
I think that as a sort of macro trend, we will start to see the kind of professionalization of the industry accelerate. So I've just spoken about increasing budgets. A lot of my colleagues and other agencies will be talking about accelerating budgets. And as that happens, we are going to have to start being a lot more rigorous. And clients are going to expect that, and rightly so. So I think that what you'll see is not just that the networks will sort of accelerate their focus on measurement, but actually the influencers themselves are going to start thinking about, what are the analytics that I'm getting? What is my point of difference as an influencer? What kind of people are engaging with my content? These are the things that they're thinking about already, but they might start to apply a bit more of a commercial lens to that. I don't think that that's necessarily a bad thing, because that's not, you know, the stuff that's great content is going to be the creative, personal, unique stuff anyway. So I'm not saying stop doing that and start holding up pictures of products. But I think that people will build this appreciation for, what is my proposition here? And I think that's a good thing.
A big thanks to Tom for coming on the show. You've been listening to Blogosphere Serious Influence with me, Alice Audley. Join us next week for a brand new episode. Until then, be sure to check out blogosphere.magazine.com for influencer industry updates. And why not treat yourself to a magazine subscription whilst you're there?